Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about 4K phases matter, of which time crystals is an example that I will talk about in some depth. Okay, so what do I mean by phases of matter? Of course, it's a very familiar concept in condensed matter physics. You know, you have some parameters, you can vary them, and there are distinct phases which are separated by phase transitions. So a phase of matter is a set of systems which can be related, which can be formed into each other without going through a phase transition. So, for example, liquid and gas are the same phase in this definition. So, of course, you know, these are, you know, very, very old phases of matter, and then they, you know, there are many different phases of matter which people study in more modern systems. So there's really two kinds of phases of matter. There's the Landau phases, which are characterized by the fact that they have a spontaneously broken symmetry. So, for example, you know, the solid phase spontaneously breaks crystal symmetries. And so you can only change the symmetry of a system by crossing a phase transition, so that's why there are different phases. And then there are the more exciting new phases, topological phases, which are distinguished by in more subtle ways as related to topological response and things like that. So, for example, fractional quantum Hall effect, spin liquids, topological insulators, these are all the kinds of systems that people have been considering in terms of topological phases. But I kind of want to go, before I go to the rest of the talk, I want to advertise a little bit. I'm going to be talking about 4K phases of matter, but topological phases was really my first love, as it were. So, for example, I have this ongoing project I'm working on with topological phases of spatial symmetries, where we basically explain how do you gauge a spatial symmetry. You can probe responses of topological phases by gauging the symmetries. And so here we talk about gauging spatial symmetries. But that's not what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my talk. I want to actually go beyond the traditional notion of what a phase of matter is by going out of equilibrium. So normally when we consider phases of matter, we would say that we have a system coupled to a heat bath at some temperature, and the heat bath causes the system to thermalize, and it'll go into some kind of Boltzmann state, for example. And so we will talk about phase of matter in a system like this, coupled to a heat bath. But the question is, can we go beyond this? Well, one thing we can do is we can actually, you know, remove a heat bath, take this heat bath, just get rid of it. And we just have a system in isolation, not talking to anything outside at all. And so what happens then? So one thing that we can do is we can just start the system in some initial state. Now it's isolated, so it evolves unitarily under a Hamiltonian. And we can say, you know, what happens under this time evolution as t goes to infinity, as in the late time regime. And so what we know is that if you look at the local observables, the system usually will still thermalize, even though there's no heat bath. The system acts as a heat bath for itself. And so, for example, the steady state you get at long times would still be a thermal state. And this is related to notions of eigenstate thermalization. So that doesn't really give you anything new in terms of phases of matter, because it's still thermal states. But the interesting case is, what happens if a system does not thermalize? What happens if a steady state is not just a Boltzmann state, if it's some different state? And so situations where this could arise would be integral systems. We know that integral systems can break thermalization. That's kind of fine-tuned though, but other instances where this can happen are many-body localization. If you have a system with strong quench disorder, then the system can become what's called many-body localized. And it turns out that a many-body localized system does not thermalize. And there's also pre-thermalization, which maybe I'll just come back to that later. But now I want to go even a step further. Now that I'm considering an isolated system, it's evolving under some Hamiltonian, but now I can allow this Hamiltonian to be time-dependent rather than a time-independent Hamiltonian. But in order to be not too general, I'm going to impose this condition that the time evolution should be periodic in time. So that means there's some period capital T, and the Hamiltonian at T plus capital T is the same as the Hamiltonian time T. But now I'm going to do the same thing, send T goes to infinity, look at local observables, and so what happens then? Again, there are two possibilities. The system could thermalize or it could not thermalize. So if it thermalizes, it turns out for flocculation systems, I should have said this is a, when we, if we drive a system periodically, then this is what people call a flocculation system. So in a flocculation system, thermalization just means that the system heats to infinite temperature, because temperature is really the Lagrange multiplier that imposes a constraint of conservation of energy. Flocculation systems, there's no conservation of energy because the Hamiltonian isn't time independent, so there's nothing to prevent the system from just heating to infinite temperature. So the steady state would just be the infinite temperature, maximum mixed state. Okay, but that's not interesting. So really, to see something interesting, we will want to consider the cases where the system does not thermalize, and the same possibilities are available to us to prevent the system from thermalizing as in the stationary case. Okay, but here's the interesting thing. Now, flocculation systems can have new phases of matter that just could never exist in the stationary case. The fact that you're driving periodically instead of just having a stationary Hamiltonian means you get totally new phases of matter. And so that's what I want to talk about today. And so one example, which got a lot of, it's gotten a lot of press, is these flocculation time crystals. It's an example of a new phase of matter which exists only in periodically driven systems. And so because this is kind of the simplest example of a new phase of matter, and also has a fancy name, I want to go over this in some detail about how it works. So this time crystal has gotten a bit of attention. Here it is on the cover of Nature, and there's also some popular science articles, but they're not necessarily very well informed. This one says time crystals, the impossible state of matter that will outlast the universe. So I'm not sure where they got that from. Okay, but what is a time crystal? A time crystal is really just a terminology that means a system in which time translation symmetry is spontaneously broken. So this name came from Wilczek a few years ago. So what does that mean? So time translation symmetry is just another way to say that the Hamiltonian of a system is time independent. I'm not talking yet about flocculation systems here, but I will come back to that. And so a time crystal means that in thermal equilibrium, the state of a system still oscillates in time. So the Hamiltonian is time independent, but the state is time dependent. So the state doesn't have the same time translation symmetry as the Hamiltonian does. So that's what it would mean. At least this is what Wilczek would have meant by this time crystal. So unfortunately, it turns out that this can't happen. There's a no-go theorem, which was proven by these guys. So this original notion of a time crystal just is not viable. It was an interesting idea that this could be a possibility, but it can't actually happen. So why am I talking about time crystals still? Well, the idea is that if we now consider these out of equilibrium systems, we can rescue the time crystal concept. So as before, I'm going to consider this context as I mentioned before, which is we have an isolated many-body system, and we consider the long-time state. And in particular, we can ask, does that long-time state spontaneously break any symmetries or not? So for example, if we had an Eisenstein symmetry, you know, just a symmetry that flips all the spins, then, you know, if your long-time state had some non-zero magnetization, even at very long times, then because magnetization is odd under this spin-flip symmetry, we would call that spontaneous symmetry breaking, because the long-time state doesn't have the same symmetry that the Hamiltonian did. And if not, we would say there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the situation of time translation symmetry is similar. If the long-time state doesn't have the same symmetries as the Hamiltonian, we call that spontaneous symmetry breaking. So for time translation symmetry, what that would mean is that your Hamiltonian could be time independent, but your state of a system could still oscillate in time forever. So that's what we would call spontaneously broken time translation symmetry. Okay, but I'm going to go one step further, because as I mentioned before, when we talk about isolated systems, we can consider periodically driven isolated systems. And that's really where we're going to see the time crystals arising in concretely. So as remember, a flocculation system just means that we drive a system periodically. So the Hamiltonian is time dependent, but time periodic. And so what, another way to say that is that we have a discrete time translation symmetry now, because the time translation is just time translations by integer multiples of this period, capital T. So it's a discrete symmetry now. And so if this is spontaneously broken, it's almost the same picture of it what I drew before. Here I'm plotting the state of a system only at integer multiples of a driving period. So if we had no spontaneous symmetry breaking, that would mean that the state of a system at long times have to have the same symmetry as the Hamiltonian, which means that it has to come back to itself after one driving period, because that's what the Hamiltonian does. So that's why these dots are all lined up. But for a time crystal, that symmetry gets spontaneously broken. And so what would happen, for example, is that, for example, you could see the system responding at a frequency which is some fraction of the original driving frequency. Here it's 1/2. So this is a fractional frequency response. And this is telling you that in this system, for example, the time translation symmetry is getting broken down spontaneously to a subgroup. So that's a Floquet time crystal. It's a time crystal in a Floquet system. So I'll tell you in a minute, you know, how to write down a model which actually does this. But let me just, since people frequently ask this, I've explained what is a time crystal, but now I want to explain what is not a time crystal. So there are some key features that the models I'm about to tell you about have, but maybe some other things that you might naively think was a time crystal don't have. For one thing, there are many-body system, you know, many-body strongly interacting system. So a harmonic oscillator, you know, you take a pendulum or something, you know, or a spring, and you let it oscillate, then it, you know, in the absence of dissipation, it oscillates forever. This is just a single degree of freedom, so I wouldn't call that a spontaneous symmetry breaking phenomenon. Spontaneous symmetry breaking is really about a many-body symmetry breaking. So the oscillations are rigid, which means that the coherence time is actually infinite, not just really big. So a laser doesn't have strictly infinite coherence time; it has just some large coherence time. So a laser is not a time crystal. We also want these oscillations to be stable to perturbations. If you really just find some fine-tuned model which has this property, then maybe that's not very interesting. We want this to be a robust phase of matter. So here's an important one. In these time crystals which I'm telling you about, they're actually reversible in the sense that you're not generating any entropy. This is sometimes confusing when you talk about non-equilibrium systems, because often non-equilibrium means dissipative. But that's not what I'm talking about here. This is not a dissipative system. It's actually a reversible process. So this rules out, for example, damped-driven pendulums. We know that if you drive a pendulum in a certain regime, then it can respond at different frequencies. But this is damped dissipative system, so that's not falling under this category of what I call a time crystal. And finally, this is a subtle one. To get something really non-trivial, I do not want to piggyback on other spontaneously broken symmetries, because that's too easy. Because the point of spontaneous symmetry breaking, it gives you an order parameter, which is rigid. So if you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, you basically have an effective single degree of freedom. So then you're kind of back to this kind of setup. So I think the interesting case is when there is no symmetry to spontaneously broken other than time translation symmetry itself. So it's not just you're just piggybacking on some other symmetry, and then you're allowing that order bound to rotate in time. So this rules out things, for example, like a frictionless pendulum. This is not dissipative, and it oscillates forever, but it also has spatial symmetries which is spontaneously broken. The whole reason why you can treat a pendulum as a rigid rod is because it spontaneously breaks spatial symmetries. And so you're really piggybacking on that. So that's not the interesting case I want to talk about. This also rules out, for example, the AC Josephson effect as well. Okay, now let me tell you about the model that we're going to write down. So the idea is, first of all, we start with a transverse field Ising model. I'm actually going to make the couplings random because I want the system to be many-body localized. Maybe I'll come back to that later. Okay, so that's... Oh, sorry. I will use the transverse field Ising model, but I actually wanted to make a different point first. Which is, how do you diagnose spontaneous symmetry breaking formally? So if we have a transverse quantum Ising model with Sirotkin, well, in fact, at its ground state spontaneously breaks the Ising symmetry. So what is the signature of that in terms of eigenstates? It's the fact that you have this degeneracy. There are two different states, each of which individually actually don't respect the symmetry, but they're degenerate. So this degeneracy is really the signature of spontaneous symmetry breaking in a stationary system. So how does it work for a 4K system? Well, first of all, So actually, the point of many-body localization is that it's not just the ground state. Here I'm talking about the ground state, which has this degeneracy. But with many-body localization, the point is it's not just the ground state that has this property. It's actually every, if you add strong disorder, which gives you many-body localization, it turns out that in that case, every single state in the whole spectrum of a Hamiltonian has this degeneracy. Right. So now if we go to a 4K system, we're going to define this time evolution operator. There should be an exp here. It's the unitary operator which describes the time evolution. This is an exponential, time-ordered exponential of a time-dependent Hamiltonian. So this describes the time evolution of the one driving period. It's a unitary operator which implements that time evolution. And the eigenstates of this operator, because it's a unitary operator, the eigenstates are phase factors, so we can write them in this form. These are the eigenstates of this operator. And then this omega, which has units of energy, we call the quasi-energy. It's basically the same as energy, except that because this sits in the exponential, it's actually defined only mod 2 pi over t. T here is the driving period. So basically, the points, if we can draw a spectrum diagram similarly, where this axis is the quasi-energy now, but 0 and 2 pi over t are going to get identified. They're actually the same. So this line, you know, you take this line, you identify these two points, 0 and 2 pi over t, it becomes a circle. So that's how you should think about these circles. It's just the spectrum diagram I was talking about before, but it's just wrapped into a circle. And so again, we have this degeneracy.
Is H over T is just Ising Hamiltonian, or is it just is it another Hamiltonian?
Right now, I'm being general, so I'm just saying we have some time periodic Hamiltonian H of T, and I'm just talking about the formal structure of that.
So you're not talking about Ising model in particular.
No, yeah, so maybe I wasn't clear. This is all a general discussion. The Ising Hamiltonian was an example of a system that's spontaneous symmetry breaking, but right now I'm being just totally general about the structure that we expect to have. So the signature of spontaneous symmetry breaking is we have this degeneracy, at least for spontaneously broken Ising symmetry, for example. But now, what happens in a time crystal? So a time crystal is actually different. This is a non-trivial fact. Time translation is a very special symmetry because it's also a generator of time evolution. So the signature of spontaneously broken time translation symmetry is a little bit different. And it turns out to be like this. So before we had just this degeneracy between two different states. And that's the signature of a spontaneously broken Ising symmetry, for example. For time crystal, it's different. We actually have, instead of degeneracy, we have two states which are separated by a quasi-energy of exactly pi. So these sit as opposite sides of a circle. And the eigenstates are actually cat states. So we have these two degenerate states here. We could also write them in a different basis in terms of these superpositions. But for a time crystal, these superpositions actually get split in quasi-energy, and they differ by exactly pi. Okay, so why does this give you a time crystal behavior? Let me explain that. Well, to answer that, let me first pose this paradox of which I will then answer. How can you have a time crystal when, by definition, the eigenstates of this Fokker evolution operator do not exhibit period doubling? Period doubling, also known as fractional frequency, is supposed to be the signature of its time crystal. But we know that an eigenstate of this Fokker evolution operator, by definition, always comes back to itself after one driving period. So it doesn't have any period doubling. And the resolution is that, yes, these eigenstates of in the time crystal case don't exhibit period doubling, but they're never the states that you actually prepare, because these eigenstates are cat states. You can't prepare cat states. they would immediately decohere. So the physical states that you would actually prepare in the lab are not these eigenstates, which are the cat states. They are superpositions of these eigenstates. So for basically, you can take superpositions of these eigenstates and form these original, and you can take two superpositions of these eigenstates. So I guess maybe I should have said sigma and minus sigma are, you should think of it as like spin, all spins up or all spins down, for example. So that's why a superposition of these two states is a cat state. But you can, so the eigenstates are the cat states. You want the physical states, because this sigma, for example, is a state with just all spins up. That's a physical state which we can prepare. So it's actually a superposition of these two eigenstates. It's this one plus this one. And if you re-express the Floquet evolution operator in terms of these sigma states rather than the cat states, then you find, as a consequence of the fact that this pi quasi energy difference, that they actually it looks like this. So the sigma goes to minus sigma, and minus sigma goes to sigma. So this means that after one time step, if you originally had all spins up, now you have all spins down, and vice versa. So this is actually showing you the period doubling behavior. In all the physical states, you have this period doubling. Even though in the eigenstates, you don't. So that's the structure of a time crystal, basically, in terms of eigenstates. So how do you actually realize this? So here's how you do it. So you take a Hamiltonian D, which has an eigensymmetry. So this is just a symmetry which flips all the spins, and spontaneously breaks it. And we're also going to take it to have strong quench disorder, which means that it's many-body localized. So in the MBL community, they often call this a spin glass Hamiltonian, although the word spin glass has many different meanings. We'll take this Hamiltonian. So this is just an Ising model with random bonds. And it commutes with this Ising symmetry. And then, so this was done in this paper. You can think about two different ways to build a Floquet evolution out of this building block. One is that you can just take your Hamiltonian to be constant and equal to D. Well, this is a trivial case of periodic time dependence if it's just constant. And so that's the zero spin glass. But there's another thing that you can do, which is like you can twist this construction. Basically, you can take your Hamiltonian and you do a two-step drive. In half of a drive period, you just apply this constant Hamiltonian D, which is the Ising Hamiltonian. And then in the other half of the evolution, you actually apply a pi pulse. So this is just a magnetic field in the x direction, which has the effect of flipping all the spins. So if you define the Floquet evolution operator for these spins, this one is just e to the idt, and this one e to the idt, but times the spin flip. So the difference between this one and this one is that in this one, you have a spin flip after every time step. And so this is like a twisted version. So they call it the zero spin glass and pi spin glass. But the pi spin glass, because if it's twisted, it's going to be a time crystal, basically. It's sort of easy to see because you have some spin configuration which gets frozen in because it's a spin glass. And then the X is going to take that spin configuration and flip it. So that's why after one time step, you'll get into a different spin configuration rather than coming back to yourself.
So why don't you just split the spin all the time? Why do you need the pilot with the MBL Hamiltonian?
Well, the problem is if you didn't have the MBL Hamiltonian, if you just do X, literally just X, then obviously the spins flip. But this isn't robust. As soon as you add some perturbations, you'll thermalize or equilibrate to some steady state for that.
So as soon as you add a perturbation to the X part, right? The flip, X flip is acting for half of the time, right? Half of the period you have, from 0 to T over 2, you just have this flip. And you just adding it to this is not robust.
Yeah, that's not robust. If you didn't also have this extra step of
it. So you're saying the second half of each cycle stabilizes?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. For example, it's easy to see, but if you took this x and you just changed the driving period a little bit, so it did instead of pi pulse, it did pi minus epsilon pulse, And already you've completely changed for periodicity. But this thing actually makes it rigid, and so the periodicity doesn't change, even if you had perturbations.
So I think I'm about to explain every level of the eigenstates. You can sort of see formally why this rigidity happens.
So the idea is that we're going to take these Hamiltonians, take these two different drives, the zero spin glass and the pi spin glass. We want something that's not fine-tuned, so we're going to see what happens if we add perturbations. And so remember that you can just compute the spectrum diagrams like I drew before for these two fins. Obviously, this d, to get the spectrum for the zero spin glass, you just take the spectrum for this d and then wrap it into a circle, so you would just get this. And because it's a spin glass Hamiltonian with an Ising interaction, it has this degeneracy, which is signaling that you're spontaneously breaking the Ising symmetry. And so for pi spin glass, you can do the same thing because x commutes with d. Sorry, this actually, this should be a d commutes with x here, not an h. You can jointly diagonalize the x and the d, and then so basically what happens is that these degeneracy just gets split up into two states that differ by pi. So this is exactly the spectrum which I argued before you should see in a time crystal. So this pi spin glass indeed is a time crystal. But let's see how the stability works out. So we're going to take the fine-tuned like special drives which I talked about in the previous slide. I'm going to call those H null of t, and now I'm going to consider some more general perturbation to that H null of t. I'm going to take H null of t and add some arbitrary perturbation. I still require it to be time periodic, but I don't place any other requirements. So what happens? Well, for the zero spin glass, I mean, you have this degeneracy, so generically expected perturbation is going to, you can do a zero order perturbation theory calculation and see what happens, and generically it's going to split that degeneracy, and so that indeed is what happens. And so these two states become non-degenerate. And so the spontaneous symmetry breaking doesn't make sense anymore, you just split the degeneracy. So a pi spin glass, what happens? Well, you can't split the degeneracy because there is no degeneracy to begin with. So basically the upshot is that actually nothing can happen. You can do perturbation theory on this thing, and you'll see that at all orders, what happens is that you dress these states a little bit, but the pi spectral pairing and the nature and the fact that the eigenstates are cat states, that is totally robust at every order in perturbation theory. And the reason is basically just that you had no degeneracy to begin with, so there's nothing that can get split. But let's think of this about this another way. Why is this happening? Well, remember that this zero spin glass, it spontaneously breaks the Ising symmetry because you have this degeneracy. And then we add in this perturbation, and we didn't say that it has to commute with its Ising symmetry. So generically, if you have spontaneous symmetry breaking of some symmetry, but then you add some field which explicitly breaks that symmetry, then the notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking is not meaningful anymore because you've explicitly broken that symmetry. But on this side, we added some perturbation, but I explicitly told you that, I'm adding some perturbation, but I sneakily said that it has to be time periodic, and time periodic means time translation invariant, so I haven't actually explicitly broken the time translation symmetry. So that's another way to say why this phase should be robust, because we're actually not, we haven't yet explicitly broken the symmetry which protects it, which is time translation symmetry. So you can, for example, say, okay, what if we added a perturbation which explicitly has twice the period? Well, then doubling the period is basically like halving the size of the circle, because it's like a Brillouin zone in time. So that then would allow these two states to couple. And so this indeed will break this time crystal phenomenon because you're explicitly breaking the time translation symmetry. But anyway, the important thing to get here is that even though I constructed these models using Hamiltonians that commuted with an Ising symmetry, the Fouquet time crystal, I called this before the pi spin glass, but now I'm going to rename it the Fouquet time crystal. The point is that it doesn't actually rely on this Ising symmetry at all. We just use that as a crutch to do this construction, but here the Ising symmetry obviously was important. You break the Ising symmetry, you've got nothing left. Here, it's actually very important symmetry is not eigensymmetry. You can just get rid of that. It's for time translation symmetry. And the time translation symmetry is getting spontaneously broken. And that is the key signature of this phase. It spontaneously breaks time translation symmetry.
So this unitary operator, the evolution that the evolved state for time t, capital T, is not local circuit, right?
Well, I mean, it kind of is. Well, I mean, any time evolution of a local Hamiltonian can be approximated by quantum circuits. I mean, there are theorems about this. But why are you asking about that?
So, suppose you have some finite system with some linear size L, and then this difference in the quasi energy, does that receive some exponential correction?
Yeah, it would.
So then exponential in which length scale? Is it the length scale associated with this unitary operator?
I think it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with that. In other words,
if you have long range Hamiltonian, how would this change?
Yeah, I mean, long range Hamilton is pretty subtle because, many parts of localization becomes less clear cut when you have long range interactions also.
Sorry, why do you think that it may change?
Hmm?
Why do you think it may change if the Hamiltonian is long range?
Well, how long range do you mean? Like some power of sufficiently fast decay is probably okay.
Yeah, I guess to be more quantitative, suppose your Hamiltonian is still local with lengths r, and as a function of r, how does this exponential correction change?
Right, so there's some length scale, which I expect would be proportional to r. I mean, one way to think about it is if you do this perturbation theory expansion, then at every order in perturbation theory, your support of your terms in your effective Hamiltonian grows. And so, you know, from that, one can extract a correlation length, if you like, or a length scale, which also determines the energy splitting as well, because you have to basically couple the whole system through this. As the Hamiltonian grows, once you couple the whole system, that's when you can start seeing this splitting happening. So that exponential decay, you can think of it as coming from that. And so if you double the range of a system, then now you're also doubling the rate at which these terms in effective Hamiltonian grow order by order. So I imagine that the length scale is proportional to the range.
So it's like B to the minus L over R, something like that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, so this is the same thing that occurs for any spontaneously broken symmetry, right? The splitting, I mean, the mechanism for the splitting is the same here as it would be in any phase. So it's the same properties you would expect to hold. We've also did some numerics. I mean, this perturbative argument is a little bit suspect in the sense that we know that many body localization does often always the physics is dominated by resonances, which are non-perturbative effects. So you can be worried about, is a time crystal still robust? But I mean, this is too hard to do analytically, but numerically we can check. And so here we simulated a model similar to the one I was discussing before with some generic perturbations to break integrability. Here is a time evolution, and you can see that indeed the response of a system is at twice the period at which we're driving. And this goes on, forever, apparently. So we also checked an exact diagonalization. So this is a tensor network TBD calculation, but by going to exact diagonalization, we can do smaller system sizes, but much longer times. And so at least at those smaller system sizes, this oscillation persists until times that is exponentially large in the system size. Okay, I think That's all I wanted to say about time crystals, if anyone wants to ask any more questions about that. So time crystal is an example of a new Floquet phase of matter. And now I want to give you maybe a more general story of what other kinds of new phases of matter can you expect to see.
So going back to your earlier comment on single degrees freedom not being an example of time crystal. So you say that's because the periodicity would be sensitive to external perturbation. Is that the sense in which you don't think that as a time crystal?
Yeah, I mean, if you have just a single degree of freedom, there's nothing to prevent the period from being dependent on the any perturbations you can add. That's right. But this, you get this many body rigidity in a similar way that you get for also spontaneous seem to break in phases. So one final word about time crystals. You know, there are some very promising experiments to actually seeing these phenomena in real systems. I guess these papers came out back to back in Nature. So one of them is seeing them in cold atoms. And then there's also a related phenomenon going on in a system of dipoles in a condensed in a solid state system. Okay, so I mean, these are not. I mean, you can argue about all the caveats about are they really seeing what they think they've seen, but it seems pretty promising that time crystals in fact exist. So now I want to talk about more generally other kinds of Floquet phases, and so. I'm going to talk about the Floquet topological phases. So I've told you at the beginning there are two kinds of phases of matter, spontaneous symmetry breaking phases and topological phases, which have this more subtle topological kind of response. And so time crystal is obviously an example of a symmetry breaking phase, albeit a new one because you have this new symmetry involved. But now I'm going to talk about Floquet topological phases. So I want to give you a general picture of what is a Floquet phase of matter. So when we talk about topological phases, by definition, we're talking about a phase which has a unique gapped ground state. So it's a zero temperature phase of matter. So we only look at the ground state. And for a topological phase, normally, by definition, we assume that the ground state is unique and gapped.
But sorry, maybe I missed something, but can you explain again? Just in your previous story, okay, when you were talking about the Ising model, okay, with disorder. So why spontaneous symmetry breaking was important there? I mean, why couldn't you realize, for example, this periodic system without spontaneous symmetry breaking? Or?
Sorry, the fact that it's the periodicity is changing is the spontaneous symmetry breaking. I'm not sure I understand the question. Because we're driving the system at some period, some frequency, which implies it has some discrete time translation symmetry. But the system responding is a different frequency, which means it doesn't have the same time translation symmetry. The state of a system does not have the same time translation symmetry as the Hamiltonian does. That's exactly what we mean by spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Or you mean spontaneous symmetry of breaking of time symmetry in the previous example?
Yeah, that's right. The symmetry which I'm talking about is time translation symmetry, that's right.
Ah, spontaneous problem.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe this was the point. Like, I had this Eichmann symmetry about spontaneously broken, and I was using that as a trick to construct a model. But at the end of the day, that's not important. I mean, you can add any perturbations which break that symmetry. The important symmetry is time translation symmetry. So, okay, topological phases has a unique gapped ground state. So we know that gapped ground states have lots of special properties, such as they have short-range correlations, their entanglement entropy has area law. Well, I guess the second one is not actually proven, but it's believed to be true. So I'm going to actually introduce a space which I call omega, which is a space of good states, basically the states which could be ground states of Hamiltonians because they satisfy all these properties. And so what is a phase of matter? It's basically saying that a phase of matter is over different states, over different, a set of states which can be connected to each other continuously without leaving this space of good states. as you cross a phase, you know, you have at each point in the phase diagram, you have some ground state. As you cross a phase transition, then either you have a second order phase transition, in which case your correlation length is diverging, so you're not you're leaving the space of states in that sense. Or you have a first order phase transition, in which case you know, your state is just changing discontinuously. So either way, there's no continuous path of ground states. There's no continuous path of states from between different phases. So we can actually define a phase of matter as just a set of elements of this space omega of states, which can be continuously connected to each other. And so mathematically, people call that the connected components of this space, the pi naught, but you don't need to worry about notation. So what is a Floquet phase of matter now? The point of Floquet phases is that, as before, we have this unitary operator which describes time evolution, and we can talk about the eigenstates of this unitary operator. And now we can ask what happens to that state as the time evolves. And what's going to happen is it has to be a loop, because by definition, it's an eigenstate of this Floquet evolution operator. So it has to come back to itself after this, you know, this is one period as you go around the loop. So it defines a loop. It's a loop of quantum states now. Before, we were just talking about points in the space of quantum states. Now we're talking about loops in the space of quantum states. So Floquet phase of matter is actually an equivalence class under deformations of these loops of space of quantum states. And so there are different things that can happen. Your loop could be contractible, you know, in which case this is basically just the same as a stationary phase. Because you take this loop and contract it to a point, now you just have a single state. And so, you know, and so this single state could be the ground state of a stationary Hamiltonian, so that's just a stationary phase. But the interesting case is what happens is if this space has holes in it, as it were, you have non-contractible loops. You have a path in the space of quantum states, which is the time evolution of these states, which is not contractible. You know, this loop is not contractible to a point. So these are the interesting new Floquet phases. They're the non-contractible loops in the space of quantum states. So this is what people call pi 1, the fundamental group. But that's just the terminology. So the point of view that Floquet phases are loops of quantum states. So you might say, how do we understand for all the different kinds of loops that can happen? Maybe this is a very complicated problem because we don't even really understand what the space of quantum states is. But we have a general framework, me and Ryan Trogon at Berkeley, which I think we believe answers this. It's based on topological quantum field theory. I won't go through the detail, but generally we believe the topological phases should be described, you know, their IR physics should be described by a quantum field theory, which in the case of a topological phase will be a topological quantum field theory. And so now we can implement this idea of loops in terms of quantum topological quantum field theories and see what happens. We actually proved a very powerful result, which we had previously conjectured based on other means, but it comes from a general framework, which is that a Floquet phase of matter, Floquet phases of matter are in one-to-one correspondence with stationary phase with a internal Z symmetry.
What do you need topological theory for this?
The topological quantum field theory is
Kidel said that a loop in a space of states is the symmetry, is a state with a C symmetry perhaps without using topological field theory, right?
So the fact
that you loop in a space of systems, in a space of states, is the same as a state with a Z symmetry. Do you need the topological field theory for that?
Well, I mean, there are arguments that you can make. In this paper, we had arguments which are not based on topological quantum field theory.
Okay,
but they're not rigorous. I mean, for topological quantum field theory, you can make this argument rigorously.
With which definition of topological field theory,
though? So topological quantum field theory is, physicists probably are very unhappy with this, but it's a functor from the Bordism n category of manifolds into something else.
This is the canonical definition.
So,
I mean, I think physicists normally like to think about actions.
for trouble point, feel free. But here we're using the mathematician definition, which is in terms of these factors. Anyway, so the point of this equivalence principle is that it's a very powerful way to understand Floquet phases of matter now, because we're saying that a Floquet phase of matter, you know, is in one-to-one correspondence with just an ordinary stationary phase of matter with an extra symmetry. And okay, what does this extra symmetry mean? Well, it shouldn't be too mysterious. It's the discrete time translation symmetry, which I've already been talking about. That's the role which this symmetry is playing in the original Floquet phase. But now the point of this is that we can now leverage all the powerful results which people have done to understand topological phases with symmetries. So this goes under the heading of symmetry-protected topological, symmetry-enriched topological, SPT and SET phases. So you know, this has been a huge area of research in recent years, and people have developed lots of frameworks and ideas to understand these. But now we can apply all these directly to Floquet phases of matter. So that's pretty useful.
So do you mean by that symmetry here, time symmetry,
Well, this is a correspondence, so it's saying that for any Floquet phase of matter, you can construct a corresponding stationary phase with a Z symmetry. So in that stationary phase, the Z would just be not time translations, it would be just some internal symmetry of the theory. But the physical interpretation of it is that if you go back to a Floquet phase of matter, this symmetry is like a time translation.
What do you call by Z symmetry here?
It's symmetry. I mean, Z is just for group structure, so it's saying that it's a group with one generator which has infinite order. Is that not clear?
I don't have any example.
It's Euclidean, so it's Euclidean. Like those diffusions are considered Euclidean, so like in principle, like you don't need to think especially temporality as a symmetry. Having that as the variable that is affected by the symmetry.
So Z symmetry is actually a little bit hard to implement in a lattice model because generally lattice models don't have enough degrees of freedom. You would always have Zn for some n. Maybe that's part of the confusion. So this correspondence is a little bit tricky because of that. But generally for most purposes, you can sort of replace Z with Zn without causing too much damage. So if you make this Zn, then it's really just saying, you know, you have some, for example, you know, to say n equals 2, the Z2 symmetry is just a spin flip symmetry.
But classification of phases with Z symmetry is different from the one
from. Yeah, but if you take n large enough and sort of like squint a little bit, then I mean, for most purposes, there is some n.
I mean, in Laplacian dimension, for example, I could make a phase, I could use the E8 phases.
Oh, yeah, there's some subtleties with chiral phases, that's right.
I could do something where. Classify
H1
of Z value in Z.
Yeah, so these chiral phases, they're a little bit confusing from a point of view of equivalence. I think that generally the chiral phases, what do I want to say about this? Yeah, the chiral phases, it's a bit hard to argue what does a stationary phase of an internal Z symmetry mean. But what I would argue, though, in that case, is they have to be a bit more formal and say that there are some.
I'm not sure about the chiral phase. I mean, a phase is an SPT phase in 3+1 dimension, right? Those are classified by.
Well, it depends what symmetry.
Homology and are classified by H1 of the group but in Z. So.
Beyond group. I'm not familiar with this.
Okay, we can discuss.
So anyway, the point is that there's. You know, maybe this correspondence is hard to write down in a few cases, but. But it's definitely true that the mathematical ideas that people have developed to describe phases of symmetries still carry out the Floquet phases of matter, even if you have trouble making the correspondence more concrete than that. Okay, so let me give you an example. You know, this is a very, very general statement, so we can make lots of specific examples of how this works. So let me consider a specific example of a bosonic system.
bosonic system, SPT, that means that it doesn't have any intrinsic topological order, but it's protected by some symmetry. Okay, let me just remind you, so we have this, we have, you know, my statement before, if you have also an extra additional symmetry G, then the statement I made before it gets generalized, it goes from G to Z times G. That should be pretty clear. So here I'm talking about phases of matter which has some internal symmetry G, and we want to consider a Fouquet version of this. So we're talking about loops in this, in the space of quantum states with a symmetry.
How large is D here?
Sorry?
How large is D?
D is a spatial dimension, so
yeah, how large
it could be one or two or three, or I mean, it could be anything.
I'd say that bosonic phase, SPT phase, is a classifiable group cohomology only up to a certain.
Well, okay. If you replace these equals with an approximate equals sign, then it's true that in large dimensions there are some exceptions to this, but these exceptions are not really the important thing, because the exceptions will be the same on both sides, so that's not really the thing that we're worried about here. Like in terms of its correspondence between Fouquet phases and stationary phases, the exceptions will exist on both sides. Anyway, so okay, there's an approximate equal here, so because this isn't quite right, but let's not worry about that for a moment. So phases with symmetries, bosonic systems with symmetries, are classified by group cohomology. That's just a mathematical result. So now if we're going to do Fouquet SPTs, which are...
It's okay with that statement.
No, are approximately correct. So the point is now that we'd replace the original symmetry G with the G times Z to describe Fouquet SPTs, which are the loops. And the Z, of course, is time translation symmetry. And then there's a mathematical factor you can prove about this group homology, which is it decomposes like this. And so the result is that the Fouquet SPTs are classified by two different invariants. One of them is just the usual stationary invariant. So these are the same as the ordinary stationary SPTs. So these are the groups that are contractible to a point. But the interesting new Fouquet phases are classified by the second thing. And the second thing is actually the same as the stationary classification, but in one less dimension, it turns out. So there's a really nice interpretation of this. It's a pumping. So we know that with topological phases, often to see the non-trivial features of a topological phase, you look at the boundary. So say we have a 2D system here and has a 1D boundary. And then we do one time step of the Fouquet evolution. Then in the bulk, by definition, because we're talking about eigenstates, the state has to come back to itself. But something interesting could happen in the boundary. And the thing that interesting which happens on the boundary for these phases described by this invariant is that you get a new SPT appearing on the boundary. A new topological phase appears on the boundary. And so here it's a one-dimensional topological phase, even though the original Fouquet SPT was 2D. And the interpretation is that we've actually pumped a 1D topological phase onto the boundary at each time step. So it's a pumping going on, yes?
In general, could you pump an invertible system instead of an SPT? For example, I could have a situation where the group G is trivial, and I pump an E8, a 2 plus 1 dimensional E8 phase.
Yeah, I think if you claim that the classification is some generalized cohomology theory, then this decomposition also always holds even beyond cohomology. So the Venice interpretation is the same.
I'm just quibbling with the statement with an MSPT, which perhaps you would want me just a more general invertible system, which is symmetry rather than SPT.
Yeah, it's a lower dimensional topological phase. It might not be an SPT.
It has to be invertible, but not.
Yeah, it should be invertible, that's right. Right, so this is the interpretation, it's this pumping. Okay. And this equivalence principle, which I talked about, also lets you construct these phases. This isn't just an abstract theory, I mean, you can actually write down models which do all these phases. And the trick is this thing which I call the Fouquet bootstrap. It's the idea that it's similar to what I did before to construct with pi spin glass, which was the time crystal. you take a Hamiltonian H, which has some internal symmetry, and then you define your Fourier time evolution to be that Hamiltonian, but then twisted also by the symmetry. So this is a simple trick, but it basically lets you construct nearly all the phases which are suggested by this correspondence. The exception would be, as we alluded to earlier, the cases where replacing Z with Zn is bad. But apart from that, you can generate all these phases. So, okay, so they actually have models. Since I'm running out of time, maybe I need to do this section pretty fast. So before I told you that I'm going to stabilize these phases through many-body localization, that's strong disorder. But it's interesting to see if there are also ways to stabilize Fourier phases matter. And so one way is by this thing called prefermalization. So the idea of prefermalization is that if you drive the system at a really large frequency, much larger than all the local scales of a Hamiltonian, then what happens is that you can find an effective Hamiltonian so that the Fourier evolution, even though it was originally time dependent, is approximately looks like the time evolution of a time independent effective Hamiltonian H. But this approximation is valid only up to some heating time. So remember, Fourier systems want to heat to infinite temperature. There's some heating time associated with that. And so in these systems, the heating time is actually really large. It's exponentially large in this ratio between the local coupling strength and the frequency. If this is exponentially big, I mean, yes, Fourier systems always heat to infinite temperature, but if its heating time is like really huge, so maybe you would never see that in practice. So even though you don't have any disorder to stabilize this phase, you can still stabilize a phase up to really, really long times, but without disorder. And so, yeah, I have to skip over this.
Omega was much larger than J.
Yeah, this probably should be e to the omega over J, not e to the. Yeah, it's not exponentially small. That's. Leveraging this idea, we proved that indeed all these Fourier phases can be realized by bootstrap construction, indeed exist as stable phases in this preformal regime. So they persist until very long, exponentially long times, but not infinite times. And so we have a theorem about this, which I don't have time to talk about. And so, for example, with a time crystal, you have some oscillations. So here I'm driving the system at some time period, and the red line is the state of the system at even times the drive period, and the green line is the state of the system at odd times the drive period. So as a function of time, the system is actually oscillating between these two values. And so the point is that the oscillations will persist until some very long time t star, which is exponentially long, and then eventually they will decay. But maybe you would never even see this t star because it's so huge. So this is a preformal time crystal. And we also have numerics. Okay. So this is one of my collaborators. So thanks for listening.
Questions?
Could you explain this pumping picture once more? I didn't find it.
So the idea is that generally with topological phases, the interesting stuff happens at the boundary. At least for SPT phases, the interesting stuff happens on the boundary. And so we generally, if you have an SPT phase, you will see some interesting things if you open up the boundary. Like with closed boundary conditions, it looks trivial. You open up a boundary, you will see interesting things going on the boundaries, like edge modes. For example, topological insulators at the boundary, they have gapless Dirac cones. So these are the non-trivial features of these topological phases. So to do that with Fourier SPTs, we open up a boundary, and what we see is that at each time step, the boundary gets changed non-trivially. It gets changed into a different boundary SPT phase at each time step. And we interpret that as saying that there's been an inflow from the bulk. The bulk has actually pumped an SPT phase onto the boundary at each time step.
So bulk is gap and boundary is gapless?
Well, the notion of gap and gapless doesn't really exist in Fourier systems anymore, but
What you mean boundary in the time space, right?
No. Spatial boundary, spatial boundary.
I mean, the system is topological in that direction, isn't it, right? So I would expect that there has to be something interesting in the...
There's no such thing as topological in time direction, right? Because it's a topological, you should be able to weak rotate however you want it with the topological phase. So, I mean, it's not that it's topological only. I mean,
basically, we're talking, okay, let's say time becomes similar to a spatial coordinate, right? The time is like a coordinate in some certain sense, right? Therefore, I would expect there has to be something similar in time boundary.
Yeah, if you have a time boundary, then there should be. But I would have to think about what do we exactly mean by a time boundary. It's a little tricky. But in principle, you're right. There should be on any boundary something interesting going on.
So, what does under which conditions the Floquet system is topological? So for a first stationary system, if it's gapped, then hopefully not. It's typically going to be topological, but what is the condition for it? Maybe you already said it.
Well, I would say that the ground state should be like, well, sorry, not ground state, we can't have my ground state, but the state of interest should be short range correlated, it should have an area law, and non-degenerate, on a sphere. These are conditions I would say.
For but physically, what makes that happen?
What makes it happen? I mean, you write, I don't know how to answer, all of a sudden you write down a Hamiltonian such that the eigenstates have its property.
A very silly question, but are there such things, or can there be such things as, quasi-time crystals?
Well, I hope so, but we haven't found a model yet.
Okay. But you don't know of a reason why not, so.
Yeah, there's no. I don't see any reason.
I move to adjourn. Let's thank Dominic again.